Well, did you all enjoy your weekend so far? Okay, good. I've seen several of you today, and it's been quite a pleasurable day. Not sure if our PowerPoint's going to work okay, but it looks like we're going to make it with what we got. So that'll be fine tonight. I want to talk tonight about, and by the way, we're not going to be here all night tonight like we were last night. We do want to introduce this particular series, and this particular study, and it's been my experience that often in our preaching and our emphasis on not worrying, and Matthew 6 and some other passages, that a lot of times what we do is we throw a lot of terms together, and as a result, sometimes we end up with maybe some statements that aren't quite accurate. And so I want to talk a little bit tonight about this with stress, anxiety, depression, and your faith. And I'm not going to hit depression very hard tonight because I'll be talking about that tomorrow. But every day is not a good day. We get up and we turn on the TV or we turn on our radio. We're on the way to work and we hear about who got shot and who got what interstates blocked and what awful tragedies happened in overnight. And it's strange that there's just enough bad news to fill the news each day. Some of the news stations have gone to a little bit more positive kind of news and some trendy kinds of stuff. But by and large, many people start their day by sitting at the kitchen table listening to what's wrong. And as a result, it sets the tone for our day. So the economy surges and declines. We have loved ones that go off to war. We hear a bump in the night and wonder if somebody's in our house. But whatever the case, there is a sense that we get from the things that are around us that things are out of control. And because of that, what we try to do is to take control of those things that are out of control. And actually, the truth is that when people say, well, I just want to be in control, the truth is we've never been in control. And when a real situation hits us, we realize how out of control we really are. Now, I understand when people say you need to control yourself, what they're talking about, but there are times that we have an illusion that we can control things that are going on around us. We think we can control, husbands sometimes think they can control their wives, wives think they can control their husbands, and both think they can control the children, and if you just take a good look, what you'll see is it ain't working because it doesn't happen. As a matter of fact, if I'm in control of me, then I should be able to know what's going to happen in the next 30 seconds, shouldn't I? But I tell you what, I can't predict the next 30 seconds. Next 30 seconds, we may have somebody bust in the door. We may fall out on the floor. Things may happen. We don't know. But whatever the situation is, we have a lot of people that have the illusion that they're in control. When we sense that we are out of control, that's when our anxiety starts getting higher and higher, is that there's something that we're trying to control that we really may not have the ability to control. That's why we need to put our faith in the one who's in control. And that's the Lord. And He's the one that controls and has control of the outcomes. And so we trust in the Lord with all of our might. We don't lean on our own understanding. And we trust that that we're not in charge, that God is. And when we do that, then we find that our topic tonight becomes less of a burdensome topic. Now I want to define a few things in terms of stress. I want to suggest that stress is a very normal response. Stress in itself is not sinful. You heard me correct. Stress in itself is not sinful. If we take someone that is working out in a gymnasium and they're pumping iron or using the Nautilus machines, what we would expect them to do in order to build their muscle stronger is they have to stress that muscle. That is, they've got to put some resistance to it, and that resistance helps them to build muscle and thus to be stronger. I want to suggest to you that the stressors of life are there to make us stronger, and I believe that that these things can have a great benefit to us, and we can be stronger because of the trials and the things we go through. Sometimes when we ask the Lord to give us strength, to help make us stronger in the faith. And in place of that, what we think we're going to get, we may get some more stressors in our life that in turn have the effect of producing that outcome, and that is that we are stronger in our relationship with God. There are three basic responses that we call primal responses. And you've probably heard of the parasympathetic nervous system, where you have the fight or flight syndrome, and that's talked about in most basic psychology courses, fight or flight. But they missed one, and that other one is freeze. And if you look at any primal response, you look at animals and how they respond. They'll either stand still. They'll either fight or they will run. But a deer stands still. A deer freezes and looks at you. And that's the response that a lot of times people miss. And this is the spot where we don't know quite what to do, and so we just kind of stand in a daze or a trance. And often that is where we get stuck, and that's where our anxieties begin to build. I didn't say our stress. Anxiety is largely worrying over things that are beyond our control. That is, minding God's business. And that's where anxiety comes from. If we believe God is in charge and God will do all things well, and we pray that all things are done according to the will of God, then what do we really have to worry about if we trust God? God is going to see that all things work together for good to those that love Him. Do you believe that? And if we believe it, what we need to do is to practice that. Stand still and know that He is God. Stand still and know that He will not do things on our timetable. I think sometimes that God must smile at me when I tell God what my plans are for today. Now, Lord, today I'm going to do this and this and this, and I really want You to bless me while I do that. And the Lord says, all right, Art, hold on. I got some other things in mind for you today. And I get to the end of the day, and it's like, well, I look back, and it's like, well, what I planned didn't happen, but there were some good things that happened today. In the right place, at the right time, with the right opportunities, and some good outcomes happened, but not necessarily because I wanted them, it's because we trust the Lord to providentially lead us in this life. The stress response is going to be seen as a person when we come into a situation that we don't quite know what to do about it. Our heart rate's going to go up. Often our palms are going to get sweaty. Our stomach may tighten up and churn maybe a little bit. And there may be many other kinds of responses that people get that are part of the stress response of the body. And the result of that is a heightened awareness and a preparing of ourselves to face something that is uncertain. And that's kind of what the stress response is. Someone asked me, well, what is the real problem here? And the real problem that we have as Christians is we have ants. Did you know that? We got ants. Now, ants, as you can see on the board, stands for something in the way I'm talking, and that is automatic negative responses. Have you ever noticed, and I do this with people, and maybe you've done this as well, is that we talk about something's going to happen, and immediately, if we're around certain people, they will tell us why that won't happen or what's wrong with it. So if we say, well, today we're going to go out and do this, then another person may say, well, you know it's going to rain today. Do you know that if you do that, that then this is, and they'll start talking to you about all this negative stuff. And those thoughts come almost automatically as to why something won't work. I kind of find it interesting sometimes in session that I will make some suggestions on how to correct a problem. And often what will happen, or hopefully not too often, but often enough, people will fire back and say, well, that won't work. Well, we tried that. And what was the outcome? And they'll tell us about all the reasons it won't work. Now, by the time we're finished, what they've done is talk themselves into doing nothing and heighten their stress and anxiety by basically just knocking out every option that is there besides sitting there and just being worrying about a thing. The body really does not know the difference between an imagined threat and a real one. The body prepares if it perceives there is a threat. the body prepares itself with a fight, the flight, or the freeze. And it doesn't even have to be true. It doesn't even have to be real. If we have perceived that something is going to go wrong, then the body prepares itself to respond to that crisis, and thus stress, anxiety, and worrying come in big time. Anxiety makes our body think that there is real danger. Now, I want you to consider something with me about Jesus. When I first started putting this lesson together, I had this wonderful section right here about why stress was sinful and no Christian should have stress. And something didn't ring quite right about that, and so I asked myself the question, well, what did Jesus do in response to life? And I came to a whole different conclusion, and I just want to see if you had come to the same one. I want to suggest to you that stress is normal, and that the body responds to stress, and that is normal, and that that is not necessarily sinful if that's as far as it goes. And I'll talk about another word in just a moment, but let's just look at Jesus' life. Now, can you imagine Jesus? He's the God-man, and he came to show us that we can live in this body and in this life, and we can deal with each day on its terms, whether it is a exciting day, whether it's a good day, whether it's a day of crucifixion, and we can deal with all of that. He was tempted in all points like we are, yet without sin. So what that tells me is that whatever Jesus did and however he responded was not sinful. So let's look at this. And what we see is, and this is a whole bunch of things, we're not going to go into detail on each one of those, but what I note in this is that Jesus was first in a blended family. Sometimes people say, well, we're stressed out because mom and dad are not really mom and dad. Maybe I got mom but not dad or whatever the combination. So we're in a blended family and a family that's got stress going on. Well, Jesus was in a family like that too. And around town, I don't know what all the talk was, but there was some conclusion there about Joseph not being Jesus' father, and yet they're in the same family, and there's not ever been another man in the picture. Whatever the talk around town was, a small town talk of Nazareth, you can conclude for yourself or assume for yourself. But what I know is that there were other children in the family, and some of his own brothers did not believe that he was the Messiah. Mary knew that beyond doubt. So did Joseph, because the angels had enunciated that to them. But these brothers and sisters, at least the brothers, some of them didn't believe on him, but some did. One of those was one of the apostles, James. And so we see that Jesus had, as he was growing up, he had the normal stressors that go with any family as families grow and develop. He grew in wisdom and in stature and in favor with God and man, even in the midst of those daily activities around the carpenter shop and around the small town of Nazareth and in this setting with siblings. Let's take Jesus' baptism. He's baptized of John the Baptist, and afterwards he's taken into the wilderness in Matthew 4, verse 1 through 11. Told you I'd have some verses tonight. And there in the passage, what we see is Jesus is taken, and there he's tempted, three major temptations that happen in that 40-day period. And you recall what those are, that the devil is saying, you know, if you're the Son of God, why don't you just command, just say bread, and these rocks will become bread. And that way I'll know who you are. You're the Son of God. Prove it to me. You know, prove that you're the Son of God. And if you're the Son of God, I'm going to take you up onto the pinnacle of the temple and have you cast yourself off, and let's see if the angels come and rescue you if you're really the Son of God. And then the third occasion was that of taking him up onto a high mountain and showing him all the kingdoms of the world. I have trouble fixating on how that happened, but I know what it says. And what it tells me is that the devil was saying, listen, you want a crown? I'll give you the crown without the cross. And if you really want to be a king, I'll make you king of the world now without the cross. But what Jesus knew is that wasn't God's plan. It wasn't God's will. But yet, I want to suggest that a temptation is not a temptation if it doesn't tempt you. And so I see Jesus in that situation. Now, there were times when Jesus' followers tried to exploit him. And I'm not going to read all these verses, but you can look in John 6. And there they tried to take him by force and make him a king. Because after all, if he can turn fish and loaves into enough to feed the whole nation, think about how our food problem is going to be solved. He can feed the whole nation on just a little bit. Wouldn't you like to have something like that go on to where there's no food shortages anymore? Everybody's got plenty to eat. And so they tried to take him by force and make him a king. There again, he could have the kingdom without the cross. And so they attempted to take him by force and force him to be the king. I believe that was indeed a moment that was laden with some degree of stress. His enemies tried to trick him. In Mark 12 and 13, they'd ask him a question. And they would try to seduce him or trick him with those questions to make some statement they could hang their hat on and then bring him up on charges. He was enraged by the abuses he saw in the temple. Can you see Jesus in Matthew 21 and verse 12 in the temple without any adrenaline flowing? Here he is flipping over the money changers' tables, and he's taking a whip, and he's got some force and some power behind him so much that they scatter and run. I suppose if somebody's after me with a whip, I wouldn't be expecting them to be real nice about it. And if I were running from that, I would expect that to be a real threat to me, for me to take off and run. But that's what Jesus did. At his betrayal, we see him at the Passover supper in John 13. And there we see Judas and the other disciples. And the question is, who's going to betray you? And finally, there's Judas. And Jesus looks at Judas and tells him, "What thou doest, do quickly." You think that was a stressful moment. And then we go and we see him being disappointed by his closest followers, as we find Peter overwarming at the devil's campfire and cursing and swearing, "I know not the man." And if you look closely at the parallel text in the Gospels there, what you will see is as Peter was swearing, cursing and swearing, "I don't know the man," Jesus is walking across the portico or the porch, the open porch, from Caiaphas' office over to Annas' office, the high priest that year. And what we see is that the text says, and Jesus looked upon him, and Peter remembered the words of the Lord. How would you like to look into the face of someone that's denying your relationship? And that's exactly what Peter was doing. Do you think that might have been a stressful, disappointing, emotional moment, not only for Peter, but also for Jesus in the midst of this trial, and as he realizes that his face is set to Calvary, and here's one of his closest followers that now is saying, "I don't even know him." Jesus had death threats often. Fact is, in John 5 and verse 18, in Matthew 26, there were people that came through the crowds, were going to take him and kill him. And there was the plots against him on several occasions. We see that in Matthew, the 26th chapter, that Jesus knew that he was going to go to the cross. He had foreknowledge that he was going to be the sacrificial lamb for all the sins of mankind. And he knew that even before he came in a human body. And he certainly knew it in his body when he said, and even as John said, "This is the Lamb of God who's going to die for the sins of the world." In the garden, we see him with sweat, as it were, drops of blood. And literally, I believe what this is talking about is Jesus is in such stress that there are some medical indications of this, that he's in such stress that his sweat popped some of the small capillaries in his forehead and is red as the sweat falls down. Did you ever pray so hard you broke out in a sweat? And not only that, but this one was like drops of blood that appeared. Even he was turned on by one of his closest followers. We talked about Peter. And then ultimately on the cross, there in his anguish and distress, there he cries out, as the psalmist had foretold, my God, why hast thou forsaken me?" That's a question of despair. That's a question said in extreme stress, Matthew 27, 26. And I want to suggest to you folks that those were all moments of great stress for Jesus. And yet I read the passages that tell me that Jesus did not sin. So I therefore am led to conclude that the responses Jesus had were appropriate human responses as he lived, as the God-man lived in a human body and had appropriate responses to life situations, to life stressors, and that Jesus experienced stress in his life. So then I move to the next question, and that is one of anxiety. Stress is going to be a normal part of our life. Anybody who wants to live a stress-free life better get on to heaven, because that's the only place where you're not going to have that. And so what I want to suggest to you in this lesson is that it isn't stress that is sinful, but it is taking stress to the next level that is sinful. And that is the level of anxiety. And there we find verses that condemn, and these aren't verses necessarily about stress, but these are verses about anxiety. This is about when we take it on ourselves to try to work out our own situations, and we're worried about whether God is going to do his part. How did Jesus respond to the stressors? First thing I want to suggest is that Jesus kept life simple. And if you have stress and anxiety in your life, or stress, and you want to respond without going to anxiety, then here's what you need to do. I want to ask a question. Is the white on a newspaper more important than the black on a newspaper? Which is most important, the black or the white? And the answer is both. Without the white, you couldn't read the black. If it's all black, you couldn't read it. If it's all white, there wouldn't be anything to read. But when you put that combination together, you have a mixture of the black and the white. Now we've got newsprint. Now we have a story. Now we've got something to read. What's most important in our life is not to fill every moment with something to where we're so busy that we are on a treadmill, or we're going like if so much that if we miss our turn in a revolving door, our whole week is off. But that's how some people live their life. They live their life wound tight as a bowstring, as some of my family used to say, and just wrapped so tight and so tense that nothing can go wrong. And so it's because we don't have, we don't plan for contingencies that now we get something comes in and all of a sudden now we're in stress. Happens on the job. I'll be sitting there, kind of have my day planned out, and all of a sudden I get a zip from the CFO that says, I need this report by 2 o'clock this afternoon, and it's 11 o'clock then. And my whole day goes on hold, and I get into a rush, and I get to typing and putting reports together and assessing or analyzing some piece of data and trying to get that on paper and get it in by the deadline. Someone put me under a very stressful moment by doing that. And now what I can do is I can have anxiety, and I can sit there and worry, I'll never get this report in on time. You know, I'm going to lose my job. How am I going to pay my bills? And I just start chasing rabbits all around the room, and my anxiety leeches onto my stress, and now I'm out here all in a tizzy, and as a result, I don't do my best work when I'm like that. What would I have done in that situation? I would have added anxiety and worry and negativity to the stress, and as a result, I would have talked myself into maybe even having a panic attack. That's how that happens. It happens up here. We talk ourselves into it. Okay? We may not intend to, but we talk and think our way into it. How did Jesus deal with that? He kept life simple. There was times that Jesus took entire chunks of time to go aside into a mountain alone to pray. How many times have we gone up to a mountain to pray? How many times have we spent time in prayer and meditation? The early church did that. And by the way, there were times that they had fasting involved in that, fasting and prayer. And I think probably that word fasting may be a lost art, but it's still in your Bible. In fact, it's a lot in your Bible. You may want to take a look at that. When I do a series on food addictions, I spend a lot of time on the different kinds of fast they did in the new, in the Old and New Testaments. But that's another lesson. Meditation. Meditation is about looking at the law of God. Thy word is my meditation day and night, the psalmist said. How I love thy law, it's my meditation day and night. But Jesus also spent not only the time communing with God, but he also spent time mentoring other people. You know, one of the legacies we leave behind is in the people that we've taught to do things. And we have been the teachers for many people if we've been doing our jobs. And so Jesus spent time mentoring his disciples. He expressed his feelings when appropriate. How many times do people get all anxious because I coulda, woulda, shoulda said this, and they play out in their mind over and over and over again what should have happened, could have happened, would have happened, and so we got all this churning inside, and all the while that's churning, then what's happening is our anxiety is getting greater, and we begin to talk to ourselves internally. It's like, well, when I see them again, I need to say this and this and this, and we rehearse all these things often that never happen, but our stress levels and our anxiety rides on that, and then we find ourselves into taking on God's part. Sometimes people are very angry at injustices, and they go into a rage. Or maybe we have tears, or we have love, or we have compassion, and those feelings don't get expressed. And as a result, where do those feelings go? They don't go away. When we have the negative feeling, remember those ants? When we have negative feelings, where do they go? They often stay inside in the form of what I call unfinished business. And so when people come to see me and talk about what's going on in their life, what often I do is I spend time doing what we call unpacking. And that is, we need to go back into that stressful event, that traumatic thing that went on, and we need to go back and look at that thing because it's not over. And I know often it's not over because when the person tells the story, they tell it with the same emotion as if it had just happened. And what that tells me is the emotions are still tied to the event, and we need to unpack those two so that we can move on and get this thing unclogged. That's what anxiety does to us. Jesus also held his peace. At times, it says that he held his peace, and as a lamb that was dumb before his shears, he opened not his mouth. There's a time to talk, and there's a time just to be resolved that this isn't going to be settled. And so there's no reason to fret about it or fight about it. Sometimes we just need to resolve this won't be settled. And what Jesus taught me in this is often we win by appearing to lose. That's what the cross tells us. And so there are times that we just need not to say anything. That all that's going to do is add to the confusion and add to people just taking things and spinning them around and creating more and more chaos and anxiety and confusion. Jesus also remembered what his mission was. And I want to spend a moment here. His mission was he came to seek and to save that which is lost. And I want to suggest to you, Jesus never lost track of his mission, his purpose in life. And I want to ask you to come up in your mind with what is your purpose in life? Why are you here? What are you trying to accomplish? And sometimes people get all anxious because they don't have a goal or goals. What are you trying to accomplish? One of the most interesting exercises I do with married couples is I ask them, why are you all married? And I get the deer in the headlight. I really do. People look, and what they'll say is, well, we're in love, or we dated a long time, and that was the next step. Well, that's a horrible reason to be married, isn't it? There just wasn't anything else to do, so we went on the next thing. That's not a very good reason. So I challenge married couples to come up with a mission statement as to why does your family exist? What are you two trying to accomplish, husband and wife? What are you trying to accomplish in your relationship? And I challenge them even further because I want them, like a company would do a mission statement, I want them to have every word that has weight to it. And then I want them to, we take a little exercise and we print that out. And they have to take it home, put it over their mantelpiece or wherever they display things, and then they have to remember what their mission is. Now, once you know where you're heading, you know what to do and what not to do. So in life, if we know where we're heading, we know what to do and what not to do. If you're a Christian heading for heaven, if that is your mission, that is your goal, then you know what to do and what not to do. Your decisions are already made for you. All you got to do is follow the plan. You know there's certain things that will not get you closer to heaven, that will get you closer to torment. And so those things would not be activities we would do because they're contrary to our mission. And in the same way, in life, what we need to look at is that we need, as a family, to be on the same page. And so we ask the question, how is this going to help us more to reach our goal? Now, not all goals in families are long-term goals. Some are short-term. And so someone may say, well, my goal is this year, or our goals are this year, to retire our debt or to retire one of our debts or whatever. That may be a financial goal. And if that's the mission, then you're not going to accomplish that if you don't follow your budget. See how all that feeds in together? When you know where you're going, you know what to do. And there will be some stressors along the way that'll confuse that, but those are just bumps in the road and don't necessarily have to have anxiety laden on them because you know what you're going to do, you know what the plan is, you know what fits and you know what doesn't fit, and you're on the same page heading the same direction. We need to remember our mission. We don't let people push us into situations. In John the 11th, in decisions, John the 11th chapter, you remember that with Lazarus being dead, one of the sisters there said, well, Lord, if you'd been here, my brother wouldn't have died. She was really saying, you let us down. And they had sent for Jesus, and Jesus didn't go immediately. He delayed. You remember that part of it? And what that tells me is, Jesus didn't let other people make his decisions. That Jesus was in charge of his life, and he made his decisions, and he lived with those decisions, even though these sisters, one of them at least, didn't like that. But Jesus did what he needed to do. Social beings is who we are. We have a social life. We speak to each other. We interact with each other, and so forth. And remember the woman at the well. Is Jesus struck up a conversation with a woman he didn't know? And he wasn't coming on to her. He merely struck up a conversation and asked her to get him a drink of water. But I want you to look how Jesus worked that, and he worked it for the glory of God. I'm real big lately on the glory of God because I think everything we do needs to be to the glory of God, not to the glory of me. And if we're working for the glory of God, then why would we have any reason to be anxious? So whether we're alive, we're working for God, or whether we're dead, we're with the Lord. And so what would I have to be anxious about? The Lord is my helper. What shall I fear? What shall man do unto me? The Hebrew writer talked about. We can say that with good courage if our faith and our trust is in the direction of God. So if I'm heading to heaven, and that's my goal, and someone steps out here and decides to interrupt my life, guess what? You may have done me a favor, I just got there quicker. But I'm not going to end my life. As long as I'm living, I'm living to the glory of God. That's our plan, that's our goal, that's our mission, that's what it's all about. That's what your home's about. That's what your personal life is about, is bringing glory into God and to His cause, and all the glory being in the church and in Jesus Christ for all ages. Amen. Jesus used simple lessons in life. He said, consider the lilies of the field. Look at these flowers. You know, when's the last time you stopped to look at a flower? Now, maybe some of you looked at one recently. But looking at the flowers, one of the things I do with people recovering from addiction, from their addictions, is we live in a wooded area and we got lots of flowers and plants and all kinds of stuff. It's a men's recovery house. And it's interesting to see these men sit out on the porch. And there they'll watch the birds come to the bird feeder, and they count how many color of finches that come down. They will look how the feeder's bent over because the raccoons got in it the night before, and see the squirrel coming down the tree, and they'll sit and study nature, and some of them are doing it for the very first time in their life because they've been so busy running through life that they haven't lived life. When's the last time you took to look at nature? Sometimes we spend so much time looking down that we haven't looked up, and we miss out on the light show God gives us with the stars and the various constellations and the various things that happen up above our head, and we miss what the psalmist David wrote about how great and marvelous God is with the way He controls it all. You know, sometimes people worry about the craziest things. In Matthew 6, Jesus talked about some people worried they were not the right height. They're too short, or maybe they're too tall. Maybe they knock their head when they go through the door, or maybe they're so short that they have to look up to everybody and get a crick in their neck. Whatever the deal, sometimes people worry about that. You all remember back in the 70s when people decided they'd make themselves taller by wearing platform shoes, and even the men went around with their leisure suits and their platform shoes trying to make themselves taller. And then time passed, and now we comb our hair straight up, and it makes us look a little taller. Okay, worried about our height, maybe. I don't know. But Jesus says that God knows all about you. So why would you worry? Why would you get yourself in anxiety? Because God even knows how many hairs are on your head. How many of us know the answer to how many hairs are on our head? I doubt seriously you've taken the time to count them, but God knows that. And here's what that says, is God knows so much about you, He knows the detail of your life beyond what you know. Now, if He knows that about us, do you suppose maybe He's in a position to direct us and that His will is something we should live by? Jesus had levels of friends. Peter, James, and John were among the closest with Him. Jesus accepted that not everybody's going to like Him. When you preach the truth and you live the truth, there's going to be some that are going to be your enemies. The Pharisees and the Sadducees and the scribes were included in many of them in that bunch. Jesus kept His family in perspective. So when His mother asked Him to do something in John the second chapter, in terms at the wedding feast, Jesus had set a boundary about with His own mother as to what was appropriate and what wasn't. And then we can keep going. Jesus lived in the day. I'm going to skip a couple of these. Jesus lived in the day. Jesus' head was not in the next day, and it wasn't in the past. It was in the day in which He lived. I want to suggest if we want to be able to handle the stressors that can become anxieties, then what we need to do is live in the day. Sufficient unto a day is the evil thereof, we're told, I believe in the book of James. Jesus kept problems where they belonged. When people would try to throw their problems off on Him, He either dealt with them or He handed the problem back to them. And they need to, and often that happened with questions that were asked. A lawyer came to Him and tempted Him, and there's where the story of the Good Samaritan. Jesus says, here's a story, you tell me the answer. Who's the neighbor? He didn't answer the question, but He did. And so Jesus handed the problem back where it belonged. How many times do we get anxious because somebody handed us their problem and we assumed it was ours? You know what I'm talking about? Someone says, I don't know what to do about this. Or they drop somebody off at our doorsteps and expect us to take care of them. Or they drop a problem in our lap and then kind of almost like a hit and run. And here we are all stressed out. What am I supposed to do about this? What you may need to do is put the problem back where the problem belongs. If it wasn't yours, then you don't have to accept it. If it's yours to share with someone, then they need to do their part as well. It's not all my problem. Don't come dumping that in my doorstep. So we keep the problem where the problem belongs. Jesus also, as we talked last night, did not do for other people what they were able to do for themselves. And we talked about that with the moving of the stone there at the death of Lazarus, and also with the removing of the grave clothes. Jesus did not do for others what they're able to do for themselves. When you do that, you make them dependent on you. When you take over their responsibility and do for them what they need to do, you make them dependent. Now, in the mental health field, I see it all the time. Folks feel sorry because someone's got a problem. And what they do is they kind of take over that person's life. They make the decisions for them. They tell them what to do. They make their appointments for them. They just kind of step in and run someone else's life. I tell you what, there's not enough time and energy to run your life and somebody else's too. There just isn't. And so what we need to do is it's not wrong to help people, but we're not supposed to be doing all the work. Here's what I tell people when they come to see me. I will work as hard as you do, but I will not work harder than you do. So you set the pace. You do what you can do, and I'll do what I do. But this is a team effort. And don't come bring your problem to me and expect me to tell you what to do. Here's what happens when folks do that. They bring their problem to me and say, well, Art, tell us what to do. And every time when I say that, or when they say that, and I accept that and say, well, here's what you need to do, 1, 2, 3, 4, they'll go out and do that. And if it doesn't work, whose problem is it? Whose fault is it? Comes right back at me. Well, you did what Art told us to do, and it didn't work. Boy, that really backfired. He didn't know what he's talking about. So what I do is I don't tell people what to do. I tell them what some options are for them to do, and I encourage them to select from those options what's best for them to do, because they're in control of their life. Their problem is their problem. It isn't my problem. It's never been my problem. They're asking me merely to guide them and coach them in a solution, but it's not my problem. It's always theirs. It's always the person, the other person's. And so don't let people dump their garbage in your can. You need to do what you need to do. The big picture is in the middle of daily life that Jesus never forgot what the will of his Father was. And so he didn't lose sight of that. Now let's look at his teachings. I want to go to Matthew 6 just a moment. And in Matthew, the 6th chapter, we talked about a little bit of this, but here he is talking about the subject of anxiety. And that is our theme tonight, the subject of anxiety. So I want to look at this. And in this passage, you recognize this as the Sermon on the Mount. I want you to look at what Jesus says in some very simple terms. First is, he tells us that we're not to lay up for ourselves treasures on the earth where moth and rust consume and thieves break through and steal. For where your heart is, there will your treasure be also. Now, I want you to look at that. You know that, and you've probably heard lessons on that. But I want you to look at verse 25, because it says, therefore. Now, therefore is a conclusion. Anytime you see the word therefore, you need to ask, what is it there for? It is a conclusion statement. What's he concluding? He's telling us, don't put our confidence in stuff. Now, that's exactly why some folks are anxious, is their confidence in stuff. They're afraid they're going to lose something. We're going to lose in the stock market, so our anxiety level goes up. We're about to lose. Somebody's about to break my stuff, or somebody ran into my car, or whatever it is. All about stuff. I'm going to tell you what stuff is good for. It's good for the final fire. It'll all be gone one day, and all you're going to have left is who you are and how you've handled things. It's all you're going to have left. We'll all stand before God without our stuff. And so stuff isn't where my focus needs to be. If my focus is there, that's where my heart's going to be, and that's where my anxiety is going to be for the fear of loss. Now, he says, therefore, I say unto you, verse 25, be not anxious for your life. He didn't say don't be stressed. He said don't be anxious. You see how there's a difference here? What you will eat or what you'll drink, or for your body what you'll put on. And what he says is, that your life is more than what you're eating and what you're wearing. And so he says, don't stress about this. I hear people sometime will come in and say, I am so stressed. My house is about to go into foreclosure, and I don't know what's going to happen. I don't know where I'm going to live. And my response is, God didn't promise you a house. Did you see a house in there? What God promised you is your life, what you can eat, and what you can drink, and what you can wear. That's what he promised you, those four things. But he didn't promise you a car. Oh, I'm going to lose my car. My car is broken. I don't know how I'm going to fix it. We stress out about that. God didn't promise you a car. What he promised you is the basics of life. And sometimes we get all stressed because we are going to have to accept change in our life, and change often comes very hard in people's lives. I'm going to talk about that tomorrow night. But he says, don't stress about that. And he says, if God takes care of the rest of nature, don't you think he'll take care of you? And then he has this little statement here, O ye of little faith, verse 30. Did you read that? He ties anxiety to a decrease in faith. So decreased that he calls it little. Now, little doesn't mean huge. Little means that they don't have much faith. And then he says it again, be not therefore anxious, verse 31, what you'll eat or drink or be clothed. And then he tells me this, "For after all those things do the Gentiles seek." Who are the Gentiles? He's talking about people that don't know God. So why would I be anxious about the basics of life? God's going to see that those happen to me. When I do His will, God's going to see that happens. That's a promise here. And then it says, "For your," that makes it personal, "for your Heavenly Father," that means you have a personal Father that's watching after you. "He knows you have need of all these things." God knows you have need of all this stuff. Now He makes you a promise. If you will stay true to your mission, then God will add these other things to your life. That's what He says. Look at verse 33. "But seek ye first His kingdom and His righteousness." That's your mission. You do this, and God's going to do something for you. "And all these things shall be added to you." You work for God, and God's going to see that you have what you need. I didn't say what you want. What you need. And then he ends this chapter, "Be not therefore anxious for the morrow be anxious for itself. Sufficient unto a day, under the day, is the evil thereof." Do you see that, what that passage is telling you? What that says is, sometimes we have our sights set too high. And what we're expecting is for God to give us all the enchilada with all the decorations on it. And that's not what that promises. And I think I have an idea why. You tell me if we're on the right page here. Do you remember the Israelites when they left Egypt? And they were going to go to the Promised Land. But what they started doing as they were heading to the Promised Land is they started accumulating stuff. And they left off, when they started accumulating stuff, they left off longing for the Promised Land and began to long for the flesh pots of Egypt. Remember the passage, "Where your treasure is, there will your heart be also." Sometimes we don't have the extra things in life simply because we may not be able to handle them. They get in our way. One of the people who made me the maddest I've ever been in my life was a member of the church. I actually kicked him out of my house, which I've never done before. But he came into my house, and he was talking with me, and he looked around my house, and he said, "Art," he said, "when I look at all the nice stuff you have, I think that this indicates you don't have enough faith in God." Now, I think he was off base in what he said, but it really made me think. I began to think of the rich man. Jesus says, "Go sell all that you have and give your money to the poor and come and follow me, and I'll give you great treasures." And for whatever reason, that stuck so much in my mind because I didn't know the answer. Could I really serve God if I didn't have all my comfort and stuff? And so I decided I would learn the answer. So I called Sam Goble. He's an auctioneer. And I had him come to my house and I said, "Sam, I want to auction everything off." And I did, including the vehicle I drove. I don't recommend you do it, but I did it because I wanted to know the answer in my life. And I auctioned off everything I had and saw it walk away in other people's vehicles. And I took my money and gave it to the poor. I know the answer. I don't know how that applies to your life, but I know that I wanted to know that answer. Am I so in love with my stuff that I love it more than I love God? And I know the answer now. And God's been good to me. He was good to me before, but He's really been good to me since. And, you know, all that stuff comes back and you get so much that you got to haul some of it to Goodwill or to GW. By the way, they have sales the first Saturday of each month. That's a commercial. Well, let's look at the book of Philippians, 4th chapter, and here's something that we need to remember, 4th chapter and verse 6. And what it says is, "In nothing be anxious." Oh, but I missed a verse. The one just before it. rejoice in the Lord always. Again, I say, rejoice. Let your forbearance be known to all men. The Lord is at hand. Now, here's what I want us to see. This is something I use in my men's therapy group. In two programs, every morning at 9 o'clock, there's either a group of homeless individuals or a group of rich and famous individuals that are sitting around in a semicircle, and their sole purpose for being in that circle is to tell me the first thing each morning what they're thankful for. It's kind of hard to imagine people that have been homeless that don't have anything hardly, have to help them get just about everything. And they'll sit around and they'll say, you know, I'm grateful that I have a warm room to sleep in. I don't have a mattress and I don't have furniture, but I got a room. I am thankful that people have been so kind to me. I am thankful that I am starting to see some direction in my life. I am grateful just to be grateful. And on the mornings I'm up on the other end of town with the rich and famous, what I will hear them say is, I am thankful for God. I am thankful for the sunshine this morning, this beautiful day. I'm thankful for the birds outside. And you know why I have them do that? Because I don't want them starting out telling me what stinks. I know there's a lot of things wrong in the lives of each one of those people, but I don't want to hear it first thing. And I don't want them to say it first thing. It sets the tone for the day. You want to reduce your stress? I'll tell you how. Is start your day rejoicing in the Lord. Start your day with gratitude. Start your day thanking God that you're alive and that you made it through the night and that He's given you opportunities to live and to thrive this day. Start your day being thankful. And on those rare mornings when I'm home, here's what I don't do. I don't sit down and turn on the morning news and listen to an hour of what's wrong with everything. Why? Because I don't want to start my day off with stinking thinking. I want to start my day off thinking about the things that are wholesome, the things that are a good report, if there be any virtue and if there be any praise. Think on these things. Did you read that in your Bible? It's over in the book of Philippians, the 4th chapter, verse 8 and 9. And he tells us what to think about. The reason some folks are anxious is because they're thinking about the wrong things. And they're thinking about it so much and churning it over and over like a tumbler in a dryer, over and over and over. And after a while, they work themselves up into a tizzy. But if we would do this, whatsoever things are true, whatsoever things are honorable, whatsoever things are just, are pure, are lovely, are of good report, if there be any virtue and if there be any praise, think on these things. And then he says, the things which you have learned and received and heard and saw in me, these things do. Now look at this. There's a promise tied to it. If you'll think on the things that are on the higher road, there's a promise tied to it. You know what the promise is? And the God of peace shall be with you. When the God of peace is with you, I would just assume that He will bring peace with Him. Don't you think that would be a fair assumption? He'll bring peace with Him. I get distressed. Here's Christians that seem like they're everything but peaceful. They got everything but joy in their life. They walk around with their chin dragging the ground. And then if they talk about Jesus to anyone, they'll say, and I'm a Christian, don't you want to be like me? And people almost gag and run the other way because they don't want to be like us. Because we're not upbeat people. We're not people that are rejoicing often, or sometimes at least. We are people that are down in the mouth, down on life, talking about the negative, rather than being people who are grateful. Suppose you were out in the wilderness with Moses and his company, and suppose that you were out here and for 40 years, you have the same thing every day. manna. You didn't have to ask, what's for dinner? Manna. What's for lunch? Manna. Did you get Mrs. Moses' new cookbook on 1,001 ways to make manna? And the Bible says that the people who were out in that wilderness eating that manna for those 40 years, the Bible says that they murmured and God didn't let them into the promised land because of their disobedience. Where did the disobedience start? With not being content with what they had. It began with them murmuring and complaining, and that built them to the point that they had lost their gratitude, their respect, and their trust in God, because all they could do is think about what's wrong, what they didn't have, rather than what they had. That's where anxiety comes from. We compare ourselves with Joneses. I'll tell you what, on my street, I am Jones. I set the pace. On your street, you set the pace. What's the pace? The bar is high, and the bar is life in Jesus. And live it in such a way that your neighbor wants to be like you. That people will come up to you and say, you know, it's been tough times. There's been a lot of folks laid off over at the mill, and I see that you're home all the time, but you're different. What's going on? How are you doing this? How are you coping? And that gives you a chance to tell them about life in Jesus and what Jesus will do for you and what He's done in your life and how you trust Him. Even though you don't know what the future holds, you know the one that holds the future. So why would we spend our time in anxiety and frustration, worrying about things that we're unable to change? That's a tall order. In 1 Peter 5 and verse 7, we're told to cast our cares upon Him because He cares for you. I just get totally amazed. People come want to tell me their problems, Christians, and that's okay. But one of the first things I ask it where I preach as well. Folks come out and say, oh, I'm just so stressed, I don't know what to do. And when I ask them, they say, I'd like to come talk to you. It's like, well, okay, but let me ask a question first. Have you prayed about this? And you know what had him cross some of their minds? Why would that not cross your mind if you walk with the Lord that He should be the first one you talk to? You see that? And that therein is why a lot of folks are anxious about situations in life is they have not cast their care on the Lord. What that means is there are some things that you can't carry. They're not yours to carry. That's the Lord's work. He'll do it. Get out of His way, and you do the things that you can do. We often say what's called the Serenity Prayer, which is actually just the first verse of the Serenity Prayer. And it goes something like this: God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change. I think that's a scriptural prayer. God, help me to be able to accept my limits, to know where yours are and where mine are. Courage to change the things I can. In other words, that I can step up and do my part, and I know you're doing your part. And the wisdom to know the difference. You've seen that prayer by a fellow named Reinhold Niebuhr, and you have also probably not seen the rest of it. You may want to hunt that up on the internet, because the rest of it's pretty good too about the providence of God. But you hunt that up on your own. What environment do you live in? Do you know that I can get anxious simply by being in the wrong surroundings? If I'm in a situation that's threatening and dangerous, I can get anxious. I can wonder what's going on. Is somebody going to jump me? Or is something bad going to happen? So I want to suggest that one of the things we can do to cope with stress or with our anxiety is to look at where's our playground, who are our playmates, and what are our playthings. Because when we're with the wrong people in the wrong places doing the wrong things, guess what? That's going to increase your stress and your anxiety. Our mind doesn't need to feed on the things that are wrong or the things that are stinking thinking, but because out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaks. You see these things here on the side of my head? Not the earphones. Y'all have some of those? These two flaps? Guess what? They aren't garbage can lids. They really aren't. You got to watch what goes in here. Because what goes in is like with a computer, garbage in, garbage out. What goes in, what your mind dwells on, your body will act on. What you're thinking about will be reflected in how you respond. And that's how anxiety is going to come to your life. And so I simply ask you this day to be people that are people of courage. Someone says, how do I do that? That's a tall order. And I'll tell you how you do it. The word how is I use as an acronym. And it stands to me for three things. Honesty, openness, and willingness. Sometimes people get anxious because they're not honest. Because they're surrounded by misinformation. And they get anxious. Honesty means that I don't have to worry about what I said because whatever really happened, I can say it the next time and I don't have to think about what I'm covering up or what I told the other person. I just need to be honest. And I think Christians need to be honest with God, honest with himself, and honest with each other. And when honesty prevails, then we have an atmosphere in which peace can live and which God is glorified. The O stands for openness. That I'm not going to try to play catch me if you can. I'm not going to hide. I'm going to be honest about things, and I'm going to be open about them. I'll be transparent, knowing that God knows all secrets anyway. And then I'm going to be willing to accept whatever challenge God places before me, whatever opportunity, because I know the one that puts a challenge before me has equipped me to handle it. He will not allow me to be tempted above what I'm able to bear. And when I believe that, when you believe that, then you won't find yourself in an anxious moment. You'll find yourself running right at what looks like a wall because you know God's going to open a door. Did you ever notice how some things God said in the Bible didn't make sense? Told Abraham and Sarah, you're going to have a baby. Now get this, Abraham's almost a century old. And his wife's not far behind him. And do you know it was 14 years after the promise before that child was born? Sometimes God challenges our faith by telling us things that we can't figure out. Why on earth would he do that? But after you get through it, you see why. We learn a lot about God looking back. But we also need to learn a lot about God going forward. If he has seen you through other crises in your life, then he will see you through this one, whatever it is. So in nothing be anxious, but with everything in prayer, with prayer and supplication, let your requests be made known to God. Stand still. Wait upon the Lord. Last night we talked about a gentleman who had an evil spirit from the Lord, and the text says that over in 1 Samuel, that it was an evil spirit from the Lord, and that the counselors to this king, King Saul, told him that there's a person in Israel that he needed to send for to play harp music. And the reason for that was to soothe his soul. Now, we have the conflict of what God put in his life, but we also have the answer right there, is that David's playing of the harp soothed his soul. I read that, and I do stress management with people, with guided imagery and a lot of the stuff that we do in our field. And one of the things that just clicked for me is, you know what the harp does? Those high strings, those play high alphas. Now, you don't have to necessarily know what a high alpha is, but here's what you do want to know. The high alpha reduces serotonin in the brain. And when that's released, you know what? There's a calmness that comes over you. It was right there in the Bible. And when I read that, it's like, oh my, these folks knew about high alphas. Actually, I think God did and does. And that answer's right there. So you know what I did? I decided I would play harp music each night before I go to bed. I had one of those CD players that has the five discs, and I just loaded it up with harp music. And I decided I'm going to try my own guided imagery, and deep muscle relaxation. And, you know, I just woke up so sound and peaceful the next day. My body was relaxed because I listened to those high alphas and had proved the truth of that verse. Music can have a soothing effect. Remember the gratitude attitude, and also remember that what your mind dwells on, your body will act on. If your mind dwells on the things that are above, then your body will act on that, and you'll act in proportion to what your belief is in that. And then I suggest to you that we offer prayer and that you spend a lot of time in prayer. There's a lady that I ran into, and she was telling me, actually she's from a different country, she grew up as a Buddhist. And some Methodists came over her way, and she learned about Jesus, and so she joined up with them. And one of the things that she learned to do, she was reading in the Gospel of Matthew about when you pray, enter your closet. And this lady, the longest time, didn't tell me. She walked me through her day, but the first 2 hours of her day were missing. She just kind of jumped past this. Well, I get up at 5, and by 7 o'clock, I'm having supper or breakfast. And it's like, so I went back, and it's like, well, what are you doing between 5 and 7? And at first, she wouldn't tell me, so I didn't know what she's doing. And then finally, she told me. She said, well, she said, it's a secret, but I guess I know you well enough I can tell you. And she says, I sit in my closet. I said, you sit in your closet. And what are you doing? And she was spending the first 2 hours of her day in prayer and meditation. I kind of understood what Jesus said to that person that came to him when he said, I have not found so great a faith, no, not in all Israel. You know what I didn't do? I didn't say, you need to quit that. I praised her for doing it. While she has a lot to learn, she's come a long way. And I just want to suggest to you that if a person who is just trying to come to know God has figured that out, then maybe those who do know God ought to figure it out too. We are so anxious about nothing, because the only things that really count are our relationship with God. That's our lesson tonight. I'm going to stop 7 minutes short of last night. I just enjoy the way you all listen. Has this helped you? Maybe there's someone here tonight who needs to respond to the gospel. And maybe you need to take a look at your faith and your relationship with God and where God is in your life. And maybe if we put God first, then what we'll find is a lot of things will fall in place. Maybe you're here tonight and need to respond by being baptized into Christ and take care of all those old sins so you don't have to worry and be anxious about those. They'll be gone. They'll be taken care of forever. And maybe, or maybe you're here tonight and you need to render initial obedience to the gospel by hearing the gospel, believing it with all your heart, repenting of your sins and confessing your faith in Jesus as the Son of God. And this night, being immersed in water for the remission of sins, and a marvelous thing will happen, is all of the sins of your life will be forgiven. You want to do that tonight? Would you like to go home feeling clean and get a fresh start? And if you would, we'll be glad to help you. Come while we stand and sing.